on the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. Thank you, Linda O'Brien. This is Maria Sanchez, and thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard every weekday morning live at 9 o'clock Pacific at LATalkRadio.com. It's apparently there was a study out yesterday that says, or an announcement, that the majority of us, and that would be under 55, listen to the radio on our phones, on our pads, on our Androids, on our whatevers. That, and they're calling it the modern-day transistor radio, if you're old enough to know what that means. So 55-plus still hasn't gotten it. But the other thing about listening on your mobile device, of the folks who listen to NPR, 75% of them listen on their handhelds against traditional terrestrial radio, which is about 25%. So there's all kinds of ways to get the program. Before we get into today's top news stories, our first guest is going to help kind of demystify what is fracking, which is a drilling technique known as hydraulic fracturing. And we're going to get several levels of that discussion because it's political, it's polarizing. And the questions are, is it dangerous to our water supplies and our environment? The California legislature tried to put in a moratorium on fracking until the state could regulate it more. New Jersey and New York have weighed in on that. What we do on our program is we don't have people that have different opinions on at the same time. And you might say, well, why is that, Maria? Well, the reason is that I hate confrontation. So as soon as I hear people stepping over each other on other programs, I change the channel. I don't want to hear who gets to speak louder, therefore they get to be heard. No. So we will have different opinions, but not at the same time. So depending on how guests' reaction is about fracking, then we're going to get somebody else to speak with us about it from another point of view so that we get to explore all of the angles. And then later on in the broadcast, we have the president of the California Redwood Association talking to us about outdoor tips for our wood because it's spring / summer, and we need to get know what to do about, they call it DIY, do it yourself. So the news again is that the former NSA contractor who revealed the government's top, U.S. government's top secret monitoring of Americans' phone and internet data, fought back yesterday. He was on the Guardian website, which is the UK paper that first published his comments, Guardian.com, in something known, if you're familiar with Reddit, they have something called AMA, which is Ask Me Anything. So he was asked many questions. It was, he was asked about 2,000 questions. He answered 18. The session ran about 90 minutes, and some of his answers, he gets to say what he wants. Also in the news was that his dad did an interview with Fox and made some comments about that. So taking questions from readers and journalists, he said that his disillusionment with President Obama contributed to his decision to make the leaks, but that there was no one single event that led him to make that decision. His quote is, it was seen a continuing litany of lies from senior officials to Congress, and therefore the American people, and the realization that Congress wholly supported the lies. He was referring in particular to Director of National Intelligence James Clapper's testimony to Congress in March that such a program did not exist, saying that seeing him baldly lying to the public without repercussion is the evidence of a subverted democracy. The consent of the governed is not consent if it is not informed. He also said that it was an extreme honor to be criticized. His quote is, being called a traitor by Dick Cheney is the highest honor you can give an American, and the more panicked talk we hear from people like him, the better off we all are. So he said he has not had any contact with the Chinese government, and he took particular care not to reveal any United States operations against military targets. his quote, I pointed out where the NSA has hacked civilian infrastructure, such as universities, hospitals, and private businesses, because it is dangerous. He was disappointed that many of President Obama's campaign promises had not been realized. Quote, he closed the door investigating systematic violations of law, deepened and expanded several abusive programs, and refused to spend the political capital to end the kind of human rights violations like we see in Guantanamo, where men still sit without charge. So it seems like the guy is an idealist. I don't know what and who you think you are when you make a decision like this that has worldwide ramifications. And he says he's not going to come back. He's going to stay. He will fight extradition. In the meantime, however, his dad, Lon Snowden, asked for him to return home and to not leak any more information. His quote is, I hope, I pray, and I ask that you will not release any secrets that could constitute treason. I sense that you're under much stress from what I've read recently, and ask that you not to succumb to that stress and make a bad decision. I would like to see Ed come home and face this. I shared that with the government when I spoke with them. I love my son. So the other thing that Edward mentioned yesterday in the chatting is that he doesn't think that he would ever get a fair trial. And so he said he's not interested in coming back home. The father says, I have faith in our justice system applied correctly. Absolutely. You know, I would rather my son be a prisoner in the U.S. than a free man in a country that did not have the freedoms that are protected in the United States. So I can't imagine how scary that would be, being the parent of somebody who's out there, a rogue, because apparently they don't know, but he's in an undisclosed place still in Hong Kong because he checked out of his hotel where he made the revelations that, yep, I was the man. So something else that's got the UK a Twitter today, it's been dominating their press first on Sunday and then today, is the queen of food porn, Nigella Lawson, and her husband, Charles Saatchi. There was a picture published of them on Sunday with his hand around her throat. And so, of course, it made front page news. And then, again, that picture is on the paper today because he went to their government and showed up and he made a statement. And they have a way of doing things that you have to make an admission and then you get a caution. So he accepted a caution for assault. So yesterday that was, he attended a central London police station and accepted a caution for assault. Cautions are given to adults aged 18 or over for minor crimes. You have to admit an offense and agree to be cautioned, and a caution is not a criminal conviction. So his statement about what he did is, about a week ago, we were sitting outside a restaurant having an intense debate about the children, and I held Nigella's neck repeatedly while attempting to emphasize my point. So there was no grip. It was a playful tiff. The pictures are horrific, but give a far more drastic and violent impression of what took place. Nigella's tears were because we both hate arguing, not because she had been hurt. We had made up by the time we were home. The paparazzi were congregated outside our house after the story broke, so I told Nigella to take the kids off till the dust settled. So he also said the reason that he went in and got the caution is because he wanted this to blow over, and he said that if he did that, he thought that it would be short-lived. So I guess not. So then there's a whole now debate about domestic violence and domestic homicide and domestic abuse and, you know, what mitigates and constitutes that. So it's pervasive. So we have every month on our program the words of the prior month. We meet with Peter Sokolowski, who's the editor-in-chief at Merriam-Webster.com, and he talks with us about the most searched words for the month prior. So obviously he'll be visiting with us the beginning of July to talk about June, etc. And they get 1.5 billion hits a year, so it's substantial. And it says a lot about what we're thinking, and it's also worldwide, so that's interesting. But in the news today is the Oxford English Dictionary, because they 4 times a year they add and revise their entries, and this dictionary has been around since the 19th century. So they have revamped the entry for tweet to include its social networking usage. So as soon as I read this, I went on to Merriam-Webster.com, I entered in tweet, and they already have that. So there, I guess the Oxford English Dictionary is known to be more cautious in adding and revising their entries. And the man who runs it, his name is actually Simpson also, John Simpson. He said that he broke the rules to actually add this, because their rules are that a word has to be in existence for 10 years before they add it. But because tweet is so much part of our news, that they made an exception in this regard. They also added big tech words, including big data, crowdsourcing, e-reader, and mouse over. And they also added the Bart Simpson catchphrase, to have a cow. He says that while Bart Simpson made it popular, that saying can actually be traced back to 1959. So we are going to get our first guest on the phone this morning. His name is Patrick Sullivan. He is with the Center for Biological Diversity, and he is going to speak with us about fracking. And we're going to kind of get a preliminary 101 in fracking.
Hello, this is Patrick.
Patrick, good morning. You're live on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be here.
I appreciate your time. And I've just explained to our listeners that it's going to be fracking 101. So, because not everybody, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, is that, that's the slang, or is that just a euphemism or fracking?
Well, the industry and regulators use many different terms to describe this. Fracking is kind of what people have settled on for the shorthand. And fracking is at its essence a way, an extreme way, a dangerous way of producing oil and gas from rock formations that we used to not be able to get oil and gas from. What they do is they take an enormous amount of water, millions and millions of gallons in some cases. They mix it with some very dangerous chemicals, and they shoot it into the ground at very high pressure. This is a way of cracking these rock formations. And so the water is blasted underground, the rock formations are cracked open, shattered, and that releases oil and gas that the companies used to not be able to get to.
Now, this has been around for, at least in California, 60 years. So it's not anything new. Why is it making news? And why is it so polarizing? And why is it getting political?
It's a great question. I think the first thing to understand is that actually the latest forms of fracking are very new to California. There's been a very basic kind of fracking around for a long time in the state, but it was used very infrequently, and it was an old-fashioned kind of fracking that just wasn't very dangerous. But companies and the federal government have put a lot of time and research into changing the technique, into advancing it. And so now they're using chemicals that they never used before. They're using pressures that they were not able to achieve before. And they're also doing what's called directional drilling. So they will drill down and then drill sideways into the earth and then frack that well, often several times. The upshot of this is that this technique poses dangers that the old-fashioned fracking just didn't. But I guess the other reason that it's controversial in California right now is that we here in the state really had no idea that fracking was being used extensively. But about 2 years ago, it became clear that oil companies in particular were starting to bring this new technique, this new kind of fracking to the state, and they were going to be doing more and more and more of it because they have identified a rock formation called the Monterey Shale that they believe will yield a large amount of oil. So this is getting to ready to ramp up in a huge way in the state across some really important parts of the state, parts of the state that contain some of our most important agricultural areas, parts of the state that contain some very beautiful wildlife habitat. We're going to see some enormous changes if these plans move forward.
Now, why do you suggest that it's going to adversely impact if what I've read is that they make a site, they identify a site, they go down, they say that in general they only use the water and the whatever you're exploding things with once, and then that creates the production, and then they reduce the size after 2 to 5 days to be the size of a, they said, a two-car garage, so that it doesn't have the impact that it did initially when they drilled the well. So,
well, the oil and gas industry makes a lot of promises about fracking, but if you look at other states where this has been done extensively, you do see a lot of damage. In North Dakota, for example, a nonprofit media organization called ProPublica took a look at state records and said, you know, how many oil spills and frack fluid spills did this state have once fracking really got underway in North Dakota? And they found that in just 1 year, they had more than 1,000 spills of petroleum and fracking fluid. This is a procedure that is just prone to accident, and contamination and spills happen pretty frequently. I guess the other really important point to understand is that fracked wells often do not produce long-term. So what companies have to do is they drill one well, they frack it, but to get at the oil, they have to drill again and frack again multiple times. So you see in North Dakota or in parts of Texas where this is where oil fracking is, it has really ramped up. You see just an explosion of drilling and fracking. You'll see wells really right on top of each other, very close to each other, as they go again and again and again at these sweet spots in the formation that they've identified that produce oil. And the cumulative impact of that can be enormous. So in Colorado, you know, the Colorado School of Public Health took a look at air pollution around these wells, these well clusters, and they found some really nasty stuff in the air, including stuff that increases the risk of cancer and asthma and other respiratory illnesses. So I don't think, you know, I think we're still learning about how things will play out here in California, but the impacts could be pretty large.
Now, Patrick, what I have done in preparing myself for our conversation, because I knew absolutely nothing about it other than hearing, you know, fracking this, and then, of course, that with Sacramento trying to put in some curbing, if you will. So it was making the news politically, too. But what I have here, it says the fluids in the operations are 99.5% water and sand, and the remaining 0.5% of the fluids are chemicals and materials, many found in common household products.
Yeah, that's what the industry often says, that these are somehow not that dangerous. But in fact, we're talking about things like benzene, and other carcinogens that are incredibly dangerous for people, methanol, trimethylbenzene. And as far as the amount of chemicals used, I mean, keep in mind that some of these chemicals are extraordinarily potent. It does not take a lot of benzene to contaminate a water supply, to contaminate well water or to contaminate surface water. And so the danger is pretty clear. The other thing that I think a lot of people don't understand about this process, and I can understand why, because the industry tries really hard to avoid talking about it, but many of these wells are producing air pollutants. So it's not just the water that's at risk, but we're talking about pollutants coming out of these fracked wells, these drilled and fracked wells, that can be extraordinarily dangerous, but you won't even know they're there. They're not something that you can detect beyond the ordinary smell of you know, petroleum products. And yet they may be putting you at greater risk of cancer, or greater risk of asthma, or greater risk of other health problems.
So you're saying whatever's been put down is seeping out? And that must be during the process, because I would imagine when that one well is done, don't they cover it up and, you know, put a cap on it, if you will?
Theoretically. you know, the contamination can happen in a lot of different ways. I mean, one of the things that happens actually very frequently is surface spills. So a company brings in a truck full of fracking chemicals, and there's a spill just from the truck or from getting the chemicals to the truck to the well. But there's also something called flowback. So water, produced water comes back out of the well, and sometimes it's anticipated and they have a way of capturing it. Other times it's not. So in Pennsylvania, for example, very recently, last couple months, we've seen the same company have the same flowback problem out of a well in which millions of gallons of frack water came out of this well and contaminated nearby areas, including some farms. So it's a serious risk, and I think the most important thing for people in California to know is that we know so little about what's happening here in the state because state regulators don't have any fracking-specific regulations in place. They don't know where companies are fracking. They don't know how many times they're fracking. They don't know what chemicals they're using. There's no reporting system in place for fracking and no regulation, really, of fracking in California.
So let's step back a little bit, and then I'm going to get into some more specifics about things that are in the news with fracking. Tell us, what is the Center for Biological Diversity?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization that works to protect wild areas and wildlife and also to safeguard human health. We're a national organization. We have an office in San Francisco, and we have people in California who are very deeply concerned about fracking, in part because, you know, it's our mission to protect our wild areas, but also because we live here and we don't want our state to be damaged by this process.
So what are other causes that you've taken up or that you've been behind or had more notoriety about?
Yeah, well, we work very hard on protecting endangered species, the California condor, for example,
mm-hmm.
other endangered species, the polar bear, and we're also very involved in climate change work. We're working to educate people and push policy makers to fight dangerous man-made climate change so that we can preserve livable habitat for animals and people alike.
Now, do you help then with the legislature that was, I guess there were about 10 bills that were introduced by Democrats. Do you help with the lobbying in that regard? Do you get involved in the political process?
I'm not a lobbyist per se, but I've kind of had a ringside seat at how things have played out in Sacramento. And I think the great lesson for us this past session was that we really saw a sea change. We didn't win. We did not. Our bill, the bill that we hoped would pass, which would have placed a moratorium on fracking, did not win. But what we did see is a very strong change in the level of awareness and concern among lawmakers in Sacramento on this issue. When we first started working on fracking in California a couple years ago, many lawmakers were not really aware that this was going on, and they were not very concerned about it. That has changed completely. And we are seeing a growing number of state lawmakers saying, well, wait a minute. You know, is California really ready for this? Are we ready for the huge changes that that an all-out fracking boom in the state would bring to places like Monterey County and to our farms and to some of our waterways? And they are very concerned about the dangers of this.
Now, can you speak about the legislation that's in place in New York and New Jersey? I guess one of them just had something go down yesterday, I think.
Well, there have been a number of changes. You know, New Jersey has debated fracking extensively. It's not as big an issue in that state, but in New York, there has been an enormous debate over fracking. The folks there are very concerned that New York may start to look like Pennsylvania, because many of the same companies that are operating in Pennsylvania are also operating, or want to frack for gas in New York, and so they're just concerned that the kind of pollution that could happen that has happened in Pennsylvania could happen in New York, and so they have really pushed Governor Andrew Cuomo to not go forward with allowing fracking in that state. So at this point, there is a moratorium on fracking. Now, recently, there was a huge rally outside of the Capitol building in Albany because they are worried that Andrew Cuomo is going to reverse himself, that he's going to go ahead and lift the ban on fracking. And, it's pretty clear that folks in New York don't want that to happen. They're really concerned about the threats to the water in New York. And they just don't think it's worth the price that New York would pay.
And you mentioned the Monterey Shale, which I guess is what people are trying to get their hands on. And what I have seen here, it says that they estimate that 1,750 square mile area could ultimately make up two-thirds of our country's shale oil reserves. So we're talking about a significant amount of resource there. So I can see, I just wanted to put into perspective why there's this interest, because obviously that would be, we would have some independence as a country, as a state, we would have amazing revenue in terms of helping that. But you're saying that because we don't know enough yet, the damages that may be possible need to be looked into before we should allow further exploration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important issue to raise, and I'm glad you brought it up. There is apparently an enormous amount of recoverable oil in the Monterey Shale. Now, it's important to note that some oil experts themselves are saying they're not sure they can actually get at it. They don't know that this is, because of some peculiarities about the Monterey Shale formation, because it's different from the Bakken Shale in North Dakota and some other shale formations that have been very productive, they're not sure that they can actually extract oil to the kind of volume of oil that's being talked about. But if they could, I think we're pretty sure at this point that the damage to the state would be enormous. We would see a huge increase in air pollution. That's just a given. And no one really disputes that. The facts are really clear that when you have a lot of drilling and fracking going on, you have an increase in air pollution. Keep in mind that we have some of the worst air pollution in the country already. And we also have record levels of childhood asthma in this state. So, that's one danger that we would certainly see. But there's a more, I guess, prosaic concern. You know, in North Dakota, they have seen enormous infrastructure damage from their oil boom. And that's because they've got these huge trucks traveling on their highways and on their surface streets. They cause a lot of damage, billions and billions and billions of dollars of damage to these highways. North Dakota is in something of a position to pay for it. They're still a little concerned about it, but they do have what's called a severance tax. When oil comes out of the ground, they can tax it, and they can hopefully use that money to help repair this damage. Here in California, we don't have a severance tax. So when we see this boom get underway, when we see this damage to our highways and to our roads and to our bridges, we will not have that severance tax money to pay for it. I think the cost of a fracking boom for our state could greatly outweigh any benefit.
What's interesting about North Dakota, because I was in Sturgis, South Dakota last August for the annual motorcycle rally, and that all they could talk about in South Dakota was the boom in North Dakota and how it was actually rippling down into South Dakota, and that housing was an issue and housing prices were increasing and et cetera. So it sounded like the good old days of prospecting, gold rush, if you will. But you're saying that there's all these other ramifications that factor into that. And then, of course, quality of life. If we do have pollution and we do have disease, then what's the gain here, I guess, would be what's the consideration. But you said you noticed that there was a shift in Sacramento with a willingness to learn more. What do you foresee coming next?
Well, I think one of the things that's going to happen is our agricultural community is getting involved in this issue more and more. Farmers in Monterey County and across the state are very concerned about the pollution that fracking is going to bring. You know, if you have a farm in Monterey County, it's very likely that you have mineral rights not far from you that have already been purchased by oil and gas companies. So they can come and they can drill on that land, they can frack on that land, they can threaten your water, and they can threaten your air. And so I think as farms get involved, as our agricultural industry gets more and more involved in this, I think the climate in Sacramento is going to change further. And it goes back to that trade-off issue that we talked about before. If we bring in a fracking boom to the state, but it undercuts our enormously important agricultural industry, have we really achieved any economic net gain for the state, especially considering all the damage and pollution that we would see? I think legislators are increasingly thinking about that, and farmers themselves are starting to make that argument. I think once that really gets underway, I think we're going to see an enormous change. So that's why we hope that next session there will be new consideration given to some of the two-year bills that did not move forward this year. There are still a couple of bills alive in Sacramento in the Assembly that would place a moratorium on fracking. Now they're two-year bills, and we hope that they will really get new attention when the next session gets underway, as farmers start speaking out and other people here in California who have either just an interest in clean air and clean water, or whose livelihoods depend on it. People in the tourism industry, for example. We think that kind of pressure is going to really achieve something next session.
Well, and something that we haven't even touched upon, we don't have time to, is that the water itself is an issue, not just the water that may be affected, but the water that's needed for these operations versus the water that the farms need. They're having to pay more money, that like the petroleum companies can pay more than the farmer would. And so it's causing them to have to, there's a local story in Ventura County that the water system, the pressure on the local water system has already made the groundwater wells go dry. And so some of the farmers who have to either use an overdrawn aquifer for their supply or use expensive water piped in from the Sierra Nevada mountains are making the debate, can I afford still to have my avocado and my lemon groves, or should I allow somebody to drill on my property and they can pay me rights to that too? So you've got all, it's very convoluted, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. I mean, you know, and I think the thing that complicates it even more is that we still don't really know what's happening in this state. We don't know where people are fracking wells. It could be happening almost anywhere that they would find it useful. And so we're really kind of fumbling in the dark here, trying to figure out what's going on and what to do about it. But I hope very much that we will see some progress in the next session and move towards real protection for our air and water.
Well, Patrick, thank you for your time, and we'll post your contact information with the website for the Center for Biological Diversity when we post the podcast later this afternoon, so folks can get in touch with you if they so choose.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Me too, Patrick. Take care. Patrick Sullivan with the Center for Biological Diversity, a nonprofit based in San Francisco. So we will then have on the program somebody either from the Western States Petroleum Association or somebody who is for fracking, so that, because obviously he's not for fracking. And then the 10 bills that were introduced by Democrats designed to increase scrutiny and regulation of the practice. One of them is a state senator. I actually have to, as a disclosure, I'm on her advisory panel, Fran Pavlish. We'll put an invitation to her to talk about what she's done, even though it aligns with what Patrick did. So if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic that you would like us to further explore, please go on to the website at mariasanchezshow.com or the blog, themariasanchezshow.com. You can contact me. My email information is available there. In fact, even my personal cell phone number is available there because I'm able to be contacted, which I like. Because it's things that you bring up to me that show me that, okay, let's look into that. We have, for example, tomorrow on our program, there's this 10-year-old girl who is suffering from cystic fibrosis that was dying because she couldn't get a lung transplant because the way that was regulated was that if you were under 12, you couldn't go on the adult list. And so they finally, the parents had to put her into a coma because she was on her way out. And then they sued and the judge said, yes, she could get on the adult list. And so she got the transplant and apparently she's doing well. Well, we have somebody visiting from an organ donor center to talk about what it means to be an organ donor. How do they make the decision to harvest the organs? And then next week we're going to have on the program an organ donor recipient who's going to talk about what that was like for his life. So there's we have a wide variety of things that we try and explore. So we appreciate the fact that if you're as curious as we are, that you'll get the information. And obviously, everything isn't for everybody, but that's the lovely thing about what you download and what don't you download. Our guest now is the president of the California Redwood Association, Charlie Jourdain. He's visiting with us. Charlie, good morning. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm excellent. How about yourself?
Just fine. Thank you very much.
Good. So we're talking about spring-summer projects, or DIY, do-it-yourself. And obviously that means we're going to be spending more time outdoors, and that could mean that some of our things need to be attended to, i.e. our decks and our redwood decks or what have you. So we thought it would be a great time to have a conversation with you to talk about some of the things that we could do ourselves.
Great.
So
I always think right around tax time, around April 15th, is the time here in California when we want to start spending more time out on our decks. And so that's always a good reminder that it's the time to, get your deck spruced up, cleaned up, get your patio furniture out there, get your barbecue grill all cleaned up and ready to go for the summer entertainment season.
Now, I've been surrounded by wood my whole life, mostly because my folks really love it. Wood on wood, wood inside, wood outside, wood decks, wood, picnic tables, that sort of thing. And the beauty of wood is that it can withstand weathering, because obviously that's where it came from, but also it needs attention.
Yes, anything that you put outside that's exposed to the, all the elements of the weather, the sun, the rain, the temperature changes, all the various things that will fall out of the atmosphere, especially in Southern California, they will soil anything that's out there. It's kind of like if you have a car, a brand new car, and you park it in your driveway and you never wash and wax it. Well, after a couple of months, it's not going to look that new. So an exterior deck, your patio furniture, needs a good cleaning on an annual basis, and then some other periodic maintenance to keep it looking nice and performing the way you want it to.
And so what is the advantage to seasoning something or treating something versus letting it be raw?
Well, there's two things. One is appearance. A lot of people, when they build a brand new redwood deck, of course, it's so beautiful, they want to keep it looking that way. And to do that, it would require, every 1 or 2 years giving the deck a good cleaning and applying a good quality deck finish to it. Anything from I recommend a what's called a transparent stain,
mm-hmm.
something that does have a little natural tint to it. To kind of enhance the natural color and keep it looking nice. A lot of people, though, will, over the years, maybe just ignore the maintenance cycle on their deck, and the wood will, fade naturally to kind of a driftwood gray or a dark gray color. Some people find that, very attractive, and they actually like that. So there is a certain number of folks out there that will perform what we call basically the no maintenance option, is to just let the wood weather naturally and then maybe just come every year and just give it a good cleaning. and not apply a finish. But a finish can do two things. It can, you know, enhance the long-term appearance and performance of the deck by protecting it from moisture and sunlight and, you know, mildew and other microorganisms that might grow on the surface of the wood in certain areas. So it will, you know, improve the both the performance and the appearance. And then with regard to stains, they're available in a wide variety of colors. And so they, you know, from a decorating standpoint, you might want to change the color of your deck somewhat to match certain architectural elements of the house.
So stains, when I was growing up, my folks used to do like the varnish thing, but then of course that weathers too. So stains is something that the wood absorbs and there's nothing really on the surface. It's just a kind of a protectant, if you will, but it's not a seal.
Yeah, the varnish thing on a deck is really not recommended because those products are susceptible to peeling and flaking. Mm-hmm. So any kind of surface coating, especially clear surface coatings like varnishes, now you say, well, people will, you know, do that to their, put that on their wood boat and so forth. But again, they'll be down there, you know, every weekend sanding and refinishing their, the spar varnish on their boat. So that type of coating, clear coating in particular, you do not want to put on a deck. The products that are available today for deck finishes are penetrating, so they will not flake and peel over time.
And then when you say cleaning, do you mean like high pressure washing cleaning or just hosing cleaning? Or,
you know, I really prefer just using a cleaning solution and then just using a garden hose. I leave the power washing to the professionals. Mm. There are professionals out there that do this type of work. They do deck restoration and refinishing, and many of them will use power washers, but they know exactly the proper techniques, the proper pressures, the proper types of nozzles and so forth to do the job effectively without damaging the wood. As a homeowner, you can go out there to your local rental place and rent a piece of power washing equipment that can, you know, actually blast a hole in the wood if you don't know what you're doing. So generally for power washing, I say leave that up to the professionals. For your average homeowner that wants to do the job themselves, just use a good cleaning solution. There's a lot of commercial products on the market that are available at your local paint hardware store and home center that are called deck cleaners, deck washes, etc. Use those with your garden hose and a good scrub brush, and you'll end up with a nice, clean redwood deck.
And obviously redwood goes on other things too, like around spas or jacuzzis or you make furniture, et cetera, et cetera. Is there anything different about that as opposed to a deck in terms of treatments?
No, not at all. You treat it the same. The only thing about a deck is that it's a large horizontal surface, and so it is subject to a lot more things just kind of, you know, settling out there, pollen in the springtime. Can create problems with just accumulating dirt and so forth. The other things with a more of a vertical surface like a fence are a little bit easier to work with than the large horizontal surface that you have on a deck.
And tell us briefly about the California Redwood Association. What is that about? Awareness?
Yeah, we are a trade association that represents the manufacturers of redwood lumber. So our members are in Northern California, from essentially the Santa Cruz area all the way up to the Oregon border, the sawmills that produce lumber and sell into the marketplace. So we help coordinate marketing and promotional activities, technical services, and quality auditing, and we also supervise the grading of California redwood lumber.
So, Charlie, if somebody is ambitious and industrious and would like to build their own deck, do you have help with your company about that? I don't know
people
who do that.
Yeah, we answer questions all day long. If they'd like to go to our website, which is realstrongredwood.com, they'll find quite a bit of information there on redwood, why people should use redwood, where to find redwood locally, and project plans for building not only decks but trellises, planters, benches, redwood swings, and so forth. And also there's a good section on finishing, restoring, and maintaining your redwood.
Excellent. Charlie, thank you so much. I appreciate your time this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And we'll post your contact information when we post the podcast later today so folks can find you easily.
Thanks again.
You're welcome. Charlie Jourdain, he is the president of the California Redwood Association. Again, a suggestion from a listener who was like, I have an at-home project. What do you think? I was like, I don't know anything about construction at home. In fact, I haven't known a man in my life who's been handy with their hands, starting with my dad, in terms of projects. He's like, there's somebody that's more qualified than me that can do this. So any of you out there that are ambitious in that regard, my hat's off to you. So something else that this recession has affected is in the news today, and that's the marriage rate. It's at its lowest point in more than a century. It fell more than 5% during the recession. So the fact that two-thirds of first marriages are preceded by cohabitation, we spoke about that last week, and the recession's financial fallout, including unemployment and underemployment, they're saying have fueled the wedding decline. So it brings you back to the question of why get married? And I guess the big answer would be, well, one, there's love. Two, about establishing an estate, if you will. You know, pooling your financial resources. And three, if you want to have a family. Now, we know that all of those things can be done without benefit of marriage. So then I ask the question again, why get married? So I've been married more than once, and it's really something that has taken me by surprise, because my folks have been married 58 years, and I just assumed, of course, that that would be my destiny. So when I went through my first divorce, was so mortifying, because I thought, geez, I thought I was special, and now I'm just like every other sucker out there that's divorced. And I don't mean to insult you if you're divorced, it's just that's how I felt at the time. Good Catholic girl, did the right thing, followed the rules, obeyed authority, didn't, you know, act out. My curfew when I was growing up in high school was 11 o'clock. I was home at 10:55. I've just, that's the kind of person I am. It just doesn't make me right or better or anything. It's just I respect authority and I follow it. So subsequently, here I am, this Catholic girl. I meet this Jewish man through a mutual friend. She was a colleague of his, and that's how we met. And so we talk about getting married and, you know, the big white wedding and the big wedding and et cetera, which we ended up having. But and I, the first words out of my mouth, because he was a stand-up comic and his act includes the fact that he was Jewish. So when he first introduced himself to me, I said, hi, I'm Maria and I'm a Catholic. I intend to remain Catholic and I will raise my family Catholic. And if you have a problem with that, then we need speak no further. Which you could say is, wow, what was that about? And it's like, I was really clear that that's what I was going to have in my life. And he said to me, he was 30 at the time, and he said, I haven't been in the temple since I was bar mitzvahed, which is at 13. He says that religion isn't that important to me. And I was like, okay. So we proceeded with the courtship, and when we finally got engaged and we were going to have a Catholic wedding, his family had huge problems with that, because some of them were active in professing their, or honoring their faith in terms of practicing it. In fact, he has a first cousin that's a rabbi and took the time to walk to him on Sabbath to talk him out of it, because he said, you will be fulfilling Hitler's plans if you go and marry this woman and have goyim children. And so he broke up with me because he didn't think that he could do that. And I said, I totally and completely understand. If my faith is that important to me and now you discover that yours is too, I get it. I understand. So after all the dust settled, he realized that, no, that wasn't the case. He would rather be married to me. So we have four Catholic children with a Jewish surname. But that marriage didn't survive. We were married about 12 years. So I have girlfriends who are my age, who are peers. I'm a boomer, and one of them got married I can't remember. I think it was last month. And another one just got engaged last week, and she's getting married in September. And she's 68, I think. And so I think, you know what? People still are optimistic about it. We're going to leave you with our jingle. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day, and look forward to visiting with you tomorrow morning. Maria Sanchez.
Talking so cool.